Okay. So as the title or the title page says, this is joint work with Tru Lai, who is a postdoc of mine. He was a student of Jingbo Xia from Buffalo. Okay. All right. So I'll start with some very familiar things. What happens for contractions? You have the famous dilation theorem of Nash. I don't know why I said Nash. Boy, this is just Nash. If you have a contraction, then it has a unique minimal unitary dilation. All right. Now the we've seen extensions and coextensions and dilations. Dilations leave T on a semi-invariant subspace, and that's something which is essential in order to do unitary dilations. A lot of what we've seen are either coextensions or extensions where you have just a 2x2 matrix, and we'll see that mostly. Now the standard model for a unitary is just the bilateral shift on, and you can interpret the von Neumann inequality, which was of course proved a decade before Nash did his dilation, which is that if you have a contraction and any polynomial, then the norm of the polynomial is no bigger than the norm of the polynomial applied to the bilateral shift, and by the spectral theory, that's just the sup of the norm of the polynomial over the whole disk. Okay. In fact, von Neumann's proof was very function theoretic. I mean, he basically observes that it's true for the Möbius maps, and therefore for the finite velocity products, and then he shows that the convex hull of those things is the ball of the disk algebra. He doesn't do it in anywhere near close to this proof. But we're interested in the commutant lifting theorem, and the Nash-Poiesch commutant lifting theorem came out. It was a significant generalization of an approach that a theorem of Don Saracen's when he was doing Nevin-Lenepick interpolation. Gave a new proof, an operator theoretic proof of Nevin-Lenepick interpolation, and he had a commutant lifting theorem in a restricted context, and a year later Nash and Foyash prove it in general. And their theorem says that if you have your contraction T and you are given a unitary dilation, of course it doesn't really matter which one, the fact that the minimal one is unique means this is just the minimal one, direct sum, some other thing, so there's really no issue about which one. And you have another operator X which commutes with it, we might as well assume it's norm 1, then you can dilate X to an operator Y with the same structure there, so that, in other words, so that you have the compression to your original space is a power dilation simultaneously of T and X, all right? Any polynomial in U and Y compresses to the same polynomial in T and X on that original space H, okay? And Y commutes with U. And again, you get a new proof of Andoh's theorem, which is that if you have two commuting contractions, then they have a joint commuting unitary dilation, okay? You can just alternately, starting with T and X, dilate T to a unitary, lift X to something that commutes, dilate Y to a unitary, lift T that something commutes. You can see that you could iterate that, but in fact, you don't have to. You can stop after a couple steps. And if you're looking for generalizations of the commutant lifting theorem, you can't look to Andoh's theorem, for instance. If you have an operator that commutes with two contractions, T1 and T2, and you take their Andoh dilation, there is, in general, no dilation of the operator X that would commute with those two unitaries. Okay. And that's basically a consequence of the fact that there are three commuting contractions that don't dilate. Okay. Now, there is a multivariable context where this is all worked out, and this is the case of non-commutative row contractions. So a row contraction is just an n-tuple of operators that don't commute, T1 up to TN, so that the norm of that operator as a map from n copies of your Hilbert space to 1 is a contraction, or that TT star, which is a summation of TI, TI star, is less than or equal to 1. Okay, I seem to... And there's also there's an isometric dilation of this one. There's not a unitary dilation for various good reasons. But Frazo for n equals 2 and then Bunce for arbitrary n or n equals infinity show that there's an isometric dilation of T1 to TN. In other words, we can find, oh, in fact, it's coextension, so you can find SI on a larger Hilbert space where the original space is co-invariant and the compression to that space is TI, so that those SIs are isometries with pairwise orthogonal range, which is the same thing as saying that the operator S1 to SN is an isometry. Okay, and in fact, Bunce's proof is just to say you can use Nash's proof, essentially, because you just think of it as a map from one Hilbert space to another, and you die like that, and you have to figure out what the new space is, but that's how it goes. Popescu proved uniqueness, but uniqueness is the same proof. Now the model for a row contraction is obtained as follows. You take the free semigroup on n letters, so you have all the words, non-commuting, words in this alphabet, 1 to n, including the empty word, which is the identity element, and you take L2 of that, which is a formulation of Fock space, and you take the left regular representation of the free semigroups, so you have these left operators Li of a basis vector CW for any word W in your semigroup is C, I don't know why, that's a, is CIW. Okay. And that's a row isometry. And its range is proper. It misses that vacuum vector, the basis vector corresponding to the empty word. Okay. And with this model, we can state Popescu's version of the von Neumann inequality, which is if you have any row contraction, T1 to TN, and any polynomial in non-commuting variables, and you evaluate that polynomial at T1 to TN, it's no bigger than evaluating that polynomial at L1 to LN. Now, it's clear that the norm of the polynomial at T is no bigger than the norm of the polynomial at S. And S1 to SN being isometries with pairwise orthogonal range, they generate a C star algebra, which is either the Kunz algebra or the Kunz tuplets algebra. Okay? But, so in particular, the largest norm is obtained in the Kunz-Tuplitz algebra, which is generated by L1 to LN. In fact, that quotient map by the compact operators is completely isometric on the non-self-adjoint algebra generated by L1 to LN. So this norm is actually the same for all, the norm of P of S1 to SN is the same for any choice of and isometries with pairwise orthogonal range. Okay. And Popescu proves the commutant lifting theorem in this context, which is exactly the same form as the Nash-Voyage commutant lifting theorem. As you have your row contraction T1 to TN, and you have an operator X which commutes with each of the TIs. Or you can think of that as xt is equal to t times the diagonal operator with n copies of x down the diagonal. Okay. All right. So you, I mean, there's it's and if you use that form of, you can always evaluate that form of a Nash. There's a commutant lifting there, and you take any row isometric dilation, and again, because the minimal one is unique, you might as well just take that one. Then you can dilate x to an operator y on the same space, so it has the same norm as it started with and commutes with the SIs. In fact, Popescu doesn't even bother to write down the proof. He just says the same proof works, and indeed it does. Okay. So today, I'm interested in the case of commuting row contractions, which we've certainly seen quite a lot of in this conference this week. And here, I'm going to start with the model. So the model was identified first in a very combinatorial way in a number of different times. It was Bill Arvidsson who first identified it as the symmetric Fock space, and pointed out that it was a reproducing kernel Hilbert space over the ball. So I'm not going to define it here, but it does have an orthonormal basis, zeta to the k, where k is any n-tuple of non-negative integers. Okay, and you have a reproducing kernel. Okay, and you have multipliers, and particular multiplication by the coordinate functions z1 up to zn generate the algebra of multipliers as a weak operator closed algebra, and that row operator m multiplication by z1 multiplication by z2 up to multiplication by zn is a row contraction. Okay, and in fact, since the symmetric Fock space sits inside the full Fock space, you can observe that that subspace is a co-invariant subspace for the left creation operators L1 up to Ln. And when you compress L1 to Ln to the symmetric Fock space, you get multiplication by Z1 up to multiplication by Zn. And that's going to play an important role in our approach here. Okay. Well, with that model, you get the von Neumann inequality due to Drury, which says that if you have any commuting row contraction and any commuting polynomial, then the norm of the operator T is dominated by the norm of this multiplier. Okay. All right. But he didn't do the dilation theorem. The dilation theorem was done later, and there's two versions of this. There's a version due to Mueller and Vasilescu, and then there's a version due to Arvidsson. I'm more interested in the version due to Arvidsson, basically because he recognizes that the space on which the multipliers act is symmetric Fock space, and that representation is sort of critical to moving ahead, whereas Mueller and Vasilescu prove a dilation theorem for a whole family of things, but it's of kernels, but it's done in a very combinatorial way, and it's, I think, when you just, everything is just defined combinatorially, you don't really know, they're just weighted shifts with a bunch of weights, where there's some weird formula, and it's, and in their case, many parameters. So anyway, either way, there is a dilation theorem, and if you take T1 to Tn, or a row contraction with commuting entries, then you can dilate this to an n-tuple where Ti tilde is isomorphic to some multiple of the multipliers on symmetric Fock space and a normal operator, and that the U1 to Un is a spherical unitary. Now, the best way of explaining why this comes about is Arvidsson's analysis of the C-star envelope of a generic commuting contraction. I mean, because of Drury's inequality, you know that that the universal commuting contraction sits, we can embed this completely isometrically inside the C-star algebra generated by the multipliers MZ1 to MZN. Okay. And a calculation shows that those multipliers commute with the adjoints of each of the others modulo compacts, and that's irreducible. So the compacts sit inside there, and the quotient is an abelian C-star algebra whose spectrum is the sphere. Okay, so that means that the star representations of the C-star algebra are just the identity representation and representations that factor through continuous functions on the sphere. And the since this is the C-star envelope, Arvidsson's theory on dilation theory says that the sort of the maximal dilations are of the form are star extendable to the C-star envelope. So they're a star representation of C-star of M. So that means you get some multiple of the multipliers together with the image of some star representation of C of the bound of the sphere. In other words, a spherical unitary. So that that theorem actually explains the dilation theorem. Although there is one subtlety here, and that is that when you're looking at dilations, the maximal dilations for an arbitrary operator algebra, you can't just do coextensions. In general, you need to dilate in both directions, and a simple example of that is the disk algebra, where in order you have to take a contraction and dilate it to a unitary, because, all right, and that unitary can only be achieved by dilating in both directions. But here, it suffices to do a coextension, which is a property of the complete contraction property. Okay, I mean, Bill has an argument that shows that, in fact, that property implies that you only need coextensions. Okay, although the dilation proof shows that you only need it. Okay. All right, so the title leaves a little surprise on what the theorem is going to look like. Commutant lifting theorem for a row contraction is you're given a row contraction, T1 to TN, where the entries commute, and you take Arvidsson's dilation, which looks like, all right, multiplication by ZI with some multiplicity, direct sum of spherical unitary, and you take an operator that commutes with each of the TIs, might as well assume it's norm 1, then you can find a coextension of to an operator Y with the same norm that commutes with the TI tildes. Okay. Just make a few comments about the proof. Okay. All right. So we start with T, and it commutes with X, and we have this given dilation to T tilde on this bigger Hilbert space, which looks like the multiplication operators on symmetric Fock space with some multiplicity and direct sum of spherical unitary. And then we can dilate that again using the Frazel-Bunce dilation. It's clear that the multipliers on symmetric Fock space dilate to the multipliers on full Fock space, and the spherical unitary part dilates to a row isometry which is Quint's type. And then we can apply Popescu's commutant lifting and get dilate X to an operator Z on this bigger Hilbert space that commutes with T hat. And then what you'd want to try to do is just compress that down to the space K, get an operator Y. It's clearly norm 1. The question is, why should it commute? Okay, well, there are a number of ingredients, and the first one is that if you have an operator A on full Fock space that commutes with L1 to LN, then it belongs to the algebra generated by the right regular representation. That's the theorem of Popescu's and of... Pardon?
Could you say that again?
I said if you have an operator that commutes with L1 to LN on full Fock space, then it must be in the algebra Rn, which is generated by the right regular representation, okay? Instead of Ri of Cw is a C of Wi, you just put it on the right side. It's clearly in the commutant, but there is nothing else. And so then the so if I have something with multiplicity alpha, the commutant is just alpha by alpha matrices or operators with coefficients in Rn. Okay. Well, then we have the fact that I've mentioned before, which is easy to see, that symmetric Fock space is co-invariant for the left regular representation and for the right regular representation. Okay. But moreover, in fact, the compression of Ln to that space is a complete quotient map onto the multiplier algebra of symmetric Fock space. Okay. That's a consequence of a theorem of mine and David Pitts, where we do Nevin-Lena-Pick interpolation for this algebra Ln, and in particular it includes Nevin-Lena-Pick interpolation for the Arvidsson-Drury space. Okay. All right. So in particular, though, when we compress an element, a matrix over Rn to a multiple of symmetric Fock space, you get a matrix of multipliers. And that matrix of multipliers, therefore, commutes with M to the alpha. Okay. So if it's pure, if there is no spherical unitary part, then we're done. And I'll make some more comments on that in a second. Now, the spherical unitary part actually is the annoying bit. You do a bunch of sort of natural matrix calculations, and with respect to this decomposition, and you can find its lower triangular, and the upper left-hand corner is just this matrix of multipliers. Everything's good there. In the lower right-hand corner, you get an operator A of the which satisfies this identity. A is equal to UI A UI star, the sum of that. And in general, if you had an identity like that, it wouldn't imply that you commute with the UIs. But in this case, because they're spherical unitaries, you can show that it does commute with a whole C star algebra generated by U1 to UN. This was proven by Davy and Jewell in a very combinatorial way, and we give a different proof that uses just the spectral theory. I think it's much more natural. Anyway, if you put those ingredients together with a number of calculations and some other a few other observations, the theorem comes out. Okay. Now there's another commutant lifting theorem in this context, and that's due to Ball, Trent, and Vinnikoff, and I'd like to thank Ron Douglas for pointing this out to me. No analysis of this case occurs in our paper, but it will, so I tell the authors who are here that I'm going to mention your paper, which is intimately connected. So Ball, Trent, and Vinnikoff start with an irreducible complete Nevin-Lena-Pick kernel, and these were characterized by Quiggin and McCullough, and that characterization led to this theorem of Agler and McCarthy. Okay, the fact that the symmetric Fox space is a complete Nevin-Lena Pitt kernel, followed by this result of mine and Pitt's. It's also done by Arias and Popescu. But what they said is that any complete Nevin-Lena Pitt kernel, which is irreducible — irreducible just means it doesn't split it into a direct sum where all of the kernels in one piece are orthogonal to another, and that's not really a difficult issue to deal with. So if you have an irreducible complete Nevin-Lena Pitt kernel, then in fact it's just a subspace of the Drury-Arveson space. Okay, it's just the span of a certain number of kernels is a way you can identify it. Okay. And so now we can state what the Ball-Trent-Vinnikoff theorem is. And they take a subspace of — they start of some H with multiplicity, which is co-invariant for the multipliers, and they compress the multipliers to that space. And they take an operator X, which commutes with those multipliers. Let's say it is norm 1. Okay, and then they show that you can dilate that to an operator X, which commutes with all the multipliers on the larger space. So let me just explain that this theorem is a special case of our result, the case where there is no spherical unitary. Okay, because again, you can dilate all the way up to the symmetric Fox space, multipliers on symmetric Fox space. You can get this Y tilde that commutes with that. But it's so — but because it commutes, and because that's a maximal Boolean algebra, it is an operator with coefficients in the multipliers. So when you compress down, they compress to multipliers on the smaller space. Okay. And that's really what's going on. But the way you can do the proof in a few lines is that you take your T, it commutes with X, but because it dilates to M alpha instead of into M alpha direct sum U, that dilates to a multiple of the left regular representation. Popescu's commutant lifting theorem, which you remember is exactly just the Nagy-Fayage commutant lifting theorem, means that commutes with an operator Z, but that Z is just a matrix with coefficients in the right regular representation, so when you compress it down, it's a matrix of multipliers. And I guess that's my time, so I'm going to stop there.